everyone. Welcome to the In the Crease podcast. I'm your co-host, Dan Abern, and I'm joined by Kyle Devitt. It is Tuesday, April 30th, and we are coming off what was perhaps the biggest weekend of the year in terms of entertainment. Kyle, we had Game of Thrones, Avengers Endgame, and then we were privy to a Saturday featuring some of the most entertaining games of the entire season. I don't know about you, but I'm pretty fired up about the whole thing.
Well, Dan, as usual, I'm upset about a lot of things. But what I am not mad at is the level of lacrosse that we witnessed to conclude this spectacular 2019 regular season. Now we get to see the really, really good stuff. Conference championships are the second season because they give hope to everyone that is left. And as we know from all the media that you just mentioned, everything starts with hope. Avengers, assemble.
Yeah, let's go. We're doing an upsets only.
Yep.
Game by game recap. So let's start back on Friday in one of the best rivalries in all of sports. Michigan upending Ohio State 13-10. The Wolverines' first program victory against their rivals, Ohio State. Kyle, I low-key saw this one coming. Final game for the Wolverines. Have a chance to ruin the Buckeyes' shot at the postseason. Sounds like a recipe for an upset. Okay, Trey LeClaire not playing. Definitely hurt, and you're going to get to the reason why. But, you know, looking at this Michigan team, I can't believe they've only won four games this season. All of their losses have come against teams that were in the top 20 or flirted with being there. They've got a very underrated scoring group here. Four players with 30 points or more, only one of which isn't coming back next year. You got a freshman in Bryce Clay with 22 goals. You know, the deficiencies, however, are a bit obvious here. Only faced off at 33% on the year. Goalie carousel throughout the season and only saved less than 50% as a team. But I tell you what, this was their fourth win of the season and it probably validated it in so many ways.
Yeah, I think this team had to make a lot of adjustments on the fly as the season went on. Windows really went down early. They knew he wasn't going to be dropping 50 points. So they changed course and in doing so, had a lot of growing pains, and as you mentioned, a lot of injuries. It's a shame it took them this long to figure out how to score and play pressure with the proper slides. I mean, I've been saying for weeks that Ohio State is totally beatable if you stop enough of their outside shots, and this game is just further evidence of that claim. Is this an upset? Yes, but only insofar as both teams' achievements over this season dictate such a label. I think you're right, though. This was coming, and it was coming for the Buckeyes as much as it was coming for Michigan, having that motivation to just like get one last roar out, stab that dragon glass through the eye of the giant right there.
Yeah, Michigan, though, lots of positives to take away from this game going into next season. Like I said, lots of scoring coming back next year. They're going to bring in a talented crop of freshmen. Got to think that this program, you know, is steadily going to improve. Kyle, let's go to the ACC semifinals. Notre Dame 12, Duke 10.
Yeah, I thought Notre Dame going up by three goals early was huge. I mean, they basically bossed the entire first quarter. You know, we've talked about teams that like to build up leads and ride them out to victories, Maryland being the most obvious one, except for this weekend. But Duke is another team that we associate with early lead dominance. And here, the Irish flipped the script on them. You compound that with a number of costly Duke mistakes, like on the clear and in between the boxes. And this is what happens. I think that it just, things didn't drop for Duke the way a lot of times the things do drop for Duke. Do you know, the easy things, the things that maybe we don't even see on the score sheet, you know, assisting on a ground ball, pushing guys out, getting that extra help pass to get an easy shot instead of an okay shot. Didn't work out for them, but, you know, Notre Dame did all those things better and they won.
Yeah. And Notre Dame also reversed the script from their last game against the Blue Devils and chose not to slide like a bunch of crazy men. We were very critical on this very podcast about that game and how it was one of the most out of character displays from Notre Dame's defense in we don't know how many years.
Yep.
Another big factor is, you know, the specialist play from Notre Dame. You know, Charlie Leonard is having a really under the radar season as their faceoff guy, winning above 50%, which is very much uncharted territory for them. And then Matt Schmidt, who's been in and out of the cage recently, came in here, had a really solid game with 18 saves. You know, I was listening to Terry and Quinn's podcast this morning, and, you know, Duke's got a lot of time off before their NCAA tournament game. What do you do? And, you know, if you read the game story on our website, you know, Donowski was like, man, I have not done a good job with this group. And it's like, that's an interesting thing to say at this point in the season, because that very much feels like uncharted territory for them. Usually this is the time a year when they're like, oh, we're getting revved up to go. Final Four, here we come. Not so much this year. What do you think?
I think the problem is they peaked a couple weeks ago. And now they're like, what do we do now? And they kept doing the same things and they weren't getting the results because they weren't doing little things. And how do you coach a team to go back and do little things better? You're not going to make them do ground ball drills for 2 hours a day. That's not going to help you. That's just going to make them resentful. I think you just kind of have to accept the mistakes, make it fun, and push forward into the games with the mindset that you're going to win playing your game instead of adjusting to your opponent. But I want to pose another question to you about this result. Are you, if you're going into the playoffs, you're one of these teams winning an AQ, are you scared of Notre Dame? And if so, what is the thing you're scared about? Because I can't put a finger on a thing that they do better than everyone else.
Right? Yeah, but for some reason, I would be scared. And I'm not exactly sure why. And I feel like maybe it's because a player on offense can kind of come out of nowhere. Like, you know, last week, Brendan Gleeson had 5 goals. Here, Brian Kasabiel in this game has 5 goals. I think it's a little bit hard to pinpoint who's going to have the day for Notre Dame. You know, Connor Moore and Brian Willits have had their respective good games. And you know that you're probably going to get a good effort on the defensive end from them. The specialist play, while it has been a bit inconsistent, when it's strong, and it can absolutely capitulate the opposing team's game plan. So, you know, before this tournament, they were a little bit on the bubble a little bit, but I think with this victory, they're probably in. And if they win the tournament, you got to like their chances at getting a home playoff game. Yeah, I just would be afraid to play Notre Dame. I don't know why, but it just seems like a team that may or may not be getting their stuff together right before it really matters.
Yeah, they do a lot of things well. I'm just trying to like figure out what they are great at. In the past, I would have definitely said 6-on-6 and transition defense. And I don't think I can say they're good, but I don't know if they're great. But if you do all the things well, you don't have to be great at one single thing. You can use all that to win a game like they did here.
Kyle, let's go to Saturday night. I want to do a quick aside before we delve into this game, but I am so happy that they have moved this game regularly to 7 p.m. Saturday night at Maryland Stadium, Johns Hopkins in Maryland, the rivalry. It was a tremendous atmosphere all throughout the day. The tailgate was bumping, but 12,000 people saw Hopkins get a very stunning 16-11 victory over the Terrapins here. Whew.
Yeah, I am actually at a loss here. Like, I saw this scoreline after I was watching some other games that I taped and went, what? No, that's not right. We got the score reversed on the scoreboard. Something's wrong. But upon revisiting it, man, this was like a come from behind whooping. Is that a new thing? I feel like it's a new thing that we've discovered in this era of the shot clock. But my main question to take away from this is, was this a much needed wake up call for the Terps, or was it something else? Because this Maryland defense looks like it's finally imploded upon itself. there's keep your head on a swivel, and then there's keep your head from swiveling and find your man, please. You know, the Maryland defense just looked confused at points. Am I reading too much into that?
No, not at all. You know, that question you posed, though, I think we might find out here in a couple of days' time. Very pertinent question. This was a wild game in terms of how it unfolded. Like you mentioned, I was filming the game from the sideline, and 5-1 Maryland, I'm like, okay, they're taking them to the wood chipper. You know, the Maryland versus Hopkins women's game was beforehand, and if you know what Maryland women's lacrosse is all about this year, it's just taking teams to the wood chipper. They are as dominant as a team as you'll find. Then in this game, it's 7-6 Hopkins, and I'm saying, hey, Hopkins is hanging. Check it out. Then 12-7 Hopkins, an 8-1 run in the middle of the game. I think I was expecting a big Maryland run in the third quarter, and you know, there was some momentum built late, but it just never came. I wasn't surprised by Hopkins winning, because the team that is expected to win this game, the rivalry that is, very rarely does, in my observation. Every time we go into it, it's usually the opposite result. But a 5-goal margin is eye-opening and surprising. And I agree. I think Maryland's defense, which, quite frankly, hasn't been as good as it's been in recent years, got a bit exposed here. But I'm also a little taken aback by the matchups here on Maryland's defense. You had Maryland's number 3 guy in on that close unit in Jack Welding guarding Joey Epstein, the freshman, who, in my eyes, has established himself as Hopkins' biggest dodging threat. Which begs the question, did Maryland purposely not show their hand here? Did they not give Hopkins the real look that they might be planning to give them on Thursday? Now, don't get me wrong. I think Maryland tried to win this game. I'm not saying they threw it, because that's crazy. But are they saving the real game plan for the rematch? Maybe. We'll see.
Wow. That's some, like, real... That's, like, that's how, like, people from up here talk about Bill Belichick, what you just did, when they lose. It's like, wait, how did they lose? Did they do it on purpose? No one loses on purpose.
Yeah.
Come on. This isn't, like, Russian moped racing. That's not, it's not fixed, you know? I feel like what we learned here is that you cannot play a no-slide defense against Epstein or Baskin when they drive from X. You either go cross-crease and ruin their lives, or you stuff them at GLE. The approaches against both of them were atrocious. Footwork was bad. I mean, goalies, again, how many times this season am I going to see a goalie leave the cage to play guy at X? I can't handle it anymore. I can't watch it anymore. It's awful. But then what happened is Maryland kind of adjusted a little, packed it in, you know, kind of stopped, made that guy float a little farther for that shot. Maybe like a couple went wide. And then Hopkins did something that I haven't seen them do all year, which is go to their 4 and 5 guys while Maryland was still preoccupied with stopping X. They got backdoor cut like they were waiting for their buddy to open the exit doors to sneak into Avengers Endgame. I mean, they let Hopkins shoot from wherever they wanted above the cage. I've seen more pressure on millennials to work an 8-hour day.
Ooh.
Honestly. Ridiculous.
He had to get in a chirp, didn't he?
All I do is chirp, dog.
I will say this, just being on the field for that post game, a very business-like approach from Johns Hopkins. They were like, let's get the crab, let's get off the field. Maryland, not happy. I think Thursday, the rematch between these two is going to be a war. So stay tuned, folks. Kyle, let's go back to the first ever rendition of the ACC play-in, whatever you want to call it. Surprising result here. North Carolina rallying late to beat Syracuse 11-10.
And we're talking a lot about fan bases this week and like fans of things and being entertained and loving things and being passionate about them. Syracuse fans will overreact and freak out after a loss like no other fan base I have ever encountered in lacrosse. If you see that Syracuse men's lacrosse loses a game, don't go to the box score. Do a search on Google for Syracuse lacrosse forums and just soak in all the hopelessness that comes from that search. It is frightening how criticized the players and the coaching staff are publicly by their fans, to the point where, like, I don't know who is a fan and who is a troll. But fan reaction aside, the Orange did let UNC hang around, and the Heels, when you let them hang around, they go off. They scored four goals less than a minute, including one from my boy B-Cam. You can't have that sort of lapse in concentration and win games at this point in the season. No one is good enough in Division I college lacrosse to turn off for 2 minutes. No one, not even Penn State, not Yale, not anyone. And that's why Syracuse lost.
Yeah, the Orange get a ton of criticism here. They sort of look to have this game wrapped up, but UNC, who had a good amount of possession in this game thanks to a great day at the faceoff X from Zach Tucci, who also came through with one of those goals late in the game, they attacked the Orange from behind the cage and found a ton of success there, particularly Matt Gavin, who just scored two unbelievable goals on the invert late in the game. And they connected on some really low percentage shots, in my opinion, in that run. Like Gavin botting his way to the cage for the ultimate winner, and then your boy B-Cam high to low with defenders crashing their sticks all over him. A nice win for the Heels. They obviously went on to lose to Virginia on Saturday in a close loss in which they gave up a lead. But I think there's quite a bit of a positive to take away from the late portion of their season going into next year. They had to turn around after that really bad Maryland loss. They made some really interesting personnel choices, threw a bunch of freshmen out into the fray, got a huge rivalry win against Duke, and really just kind of, you know, they hung in there with some really tough teams late in their season. I feel like, you know, going into next year, there's something to build upon there.
I think what you saw here from UNC is actually kind of a blueprint on how to beat Syracuse, and that's don't dodge on Mellon, pull him out as far as you can, don't even let him slide. And then with Kennedy, you have to keep him away from guys unless he is dodging from his guys dodging from the top. Like, pull him away as well. And then you have, you know, defenders and short stick guys that don't have a ton of foot speed, and you go at them with fast guys. And you look for guys to be open on the cut, coming off of off-ball movements and picks, and you can get shots on them. And I think the other thing, people put a lot of blame on Drake Porter here. I don't really see it that way. I think he's one of the best goalies, maybe if not the best goalie in the ACC, maybe the most consistent, because everyone else has basically been replaced at one point or other in the season. You know, so I saw a lot of hate on him, and I just want to say I don't think that he deserved really any of it. He got left out to dry for a lot of those goals.
Agree. Kyle, let's go into a very special conference recap. We're going to play a little game here. We're going to do favorite and dark horse for each of the conference tournaments. We'll alternate. You'll go first with the favorite, and then I will go dark horse. Let's go to the ACC final. We've only got two teams. UVA versus Notre Dame. Who's your favorite?
I mean, this is pretty easy. We only have one choice. The favorite here, I think, is Virginia. And I think it's pretty obvious that they are, just because of that rip-roaring offense. I mean, it's stalled out a couple times. I don't think they've gotten out of third yet in the last couple weeks. But I feel like if they can engage all cylinders, this is a team to watch going into the NCAA playoffs. And they're going to get an at-large bid regardless of the result.
Yeah, and I think their RPI shot up to number two, which is crazy. But gritty win for them against the Tar Heels. Okay, so the dark horse here is Notre Dame, who, you know, even if we were picking these on Wednesday, so to speak, they would probably be a dark horse to win along with Carolina. We kind of talked about their advantages in the victory against Duke. You know, when the specialist play is really good, it can really topple an opponent. And I think if they're going to plan on beating Virginia, they're going to have to win at the faceoff X, and they're going to have a really good day in cage in order to go toe-to-toe with that really explosive offense by the Cavaliers. Otherwise, I think they have a shot. I think this is going to be a really great ACC final. All right, Kyle, the America East. The matchups are Vermont versus UAlbany and UMBC versus Stony Brook. Shout out my boys UMBC for sneaking into this tournament. The favorite is tough to pick here, but I can't pick against UAlbany. I just can't. I think they are the favorite, despite Stony Brook being on a tear late in the season and getting the number one seed here, including a victory over Albany on Friday night in the rain on Long Island.
Dan, can I pick a number one seed as a dark horse? Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay, then I pick Stony Brook. I don't think this applies to anywhere else, but I watched a fair amount of those midweek Stony Brook games, and some of them are just like rock fights. Where I just was like, and there was a certain point, I think they were playing Hofstra, and I went, why am I watching this? Why? But now look at them turn their entire season around, got a bunch of wins in a row, number one seed, you know, favored hosting America East. Unbelievable. Great turnaround. Still dark horse to me because I can't wipe those other memories out of my mind. Just can't.
All right, let's move to the Big Ten. The matchups are the same as this past weekend, Rutgers versus Penn State and Maryland versus Johns Hopkins. Kyle, who is your favorite?
I mean, pretty obvious that it's Penn State, right?
Yes. I
mean, they're rolling. Team's rolling. How are we going to beat them? Because the only team that has done it is Yale, and they did it with T.D. Ierland winning all the faceoffs. Is that how you beat them? Is that the only way to beat them so far? Yes, even though Rutgers gave them a run for their money. Yeah. You know, Rutgers put up a hell of a fight this past weekend. So this matchup is still more even than it looks. But I think Penn State's clearly the favorite.
That would leave the dark horse to be, in my opinion, Johns Hopkins. Got a big win against Maryland. Probably feeling really confident after that. And if you look at some of the ways that they're trending over the past month, they've been better at the faceoff X. You know, Ryan Darby only had two saves against Maryland, but he's come up big with some important stops and important junctures in some of their games. And then, you know, that attack unit is kind of playing well with Epstein. And when Epstein plays really well and Cole Williams play really well, they almost always win. When both of those guys are scoring, Hopkins, it just looks great. So I think that...
Or creating for other people.
Yeah, or creating for other people. And that's actually what happened a lot in the Maryland game. Forey Smith and I thought Evan Sin at the midfield, which has kind of been a bit of a drought for them this season, really stepped up and made a really impactful performance in that game. I think that, you know, Hopkins, they know that, you know, they're on the NCAA tournament bubble right now. They know that. And that they're going to have to win probably at least one more game in this tournament to get in. And if they get the AQ, man, they might just get a home game. Who knows? All right, let's move to the Big East, the absolute crazy banana land bonanza that is the Big East. The matchups are Denver versus Villanova and Providence versus Georgetown. My favorite? This is insane. Is there a favorite here?
This is the toughest one to pick. This is the toughest one to pick. I'll give you that.
I mean... Not going to pick against Denver?
Just say it.
Not going to pick against Denver? Yeah. It's got to be Denver, right?
Yes. Even though they do not do well in this tournament. But yes, that is the pick.
Who is your dark horse, Kyle?
Friars, man. Friars out of nowhere. Who is this team? I was like,
is he really, with his Northeast bias, going to pick his Friars? And you did.
I am. You can't stop the Northeast bias. Providence. I didn't see one of your games all year, but I'm picking you anyway. They're just, it's one of those teams. It's just like Stony Brook, where like they had some games. I was like scoring a game, or I was helping score a game, and I was like, is this team really going to blow another fourth quarter and lose? And somewhere in the last 3 weeks, they fixed that. You know, they plugged the hole and they figured it out. Tate Boyle started playing back up to the level. He was a preseason All-American in Cage. I think there's no other dark horse to pick, because I think you could make an argument that the other three teams could be favorites. So that's why I'm picking them as the dark horse. You can pick anyone else. You know, like that's really what I'm saying. It's not even the bias so much as like that's the tiebreaker. It's like, oh, I could drive there. So that's it.
Kyle, the CAA, the matchups are UMass versus Drexel and Towson versus Delaware. The favorite, can't believe I'm going to say it, but it's UMass. It's UMass. They are. I didn't even realize it until this morning, but UMass has almost completely replicated last season. Tough start. They are 8-1 or 9-1 over their past 9 or 10 games. And I'm like, that's like 99% being undefeated. And I was like, that's pretty much what they rode into the NCAA tournament last season when they went on that tear after that Albany loss and rattled off as many wins in a row as they did before losing to Yale. So UMass has got to be the favorite here, especially on their home turf.
The dark horse has to be Delaware. Charlie Kitchen is a matchup nightmare, right? He is long. He's tall. He's got crazy legs. If he gets around to JLE and just takes one long step up, he's immediately at 45 degrees. And can shoot. He did that against UMass this past weekend to set this matchup up. They're playing Towson. But I think that if you watch that game back from a couple weeks ago, a very recent game, that was very close. And Towson had to wait to pull away to win that one. So I'm going to go with Delaware. They also have DeLuca in Cage, who he's a tall goalie. The common thought on tall goalies is like, shoot low, they can't get down. This dude gets down. He's a sprawler, and that's weird for a goalie that's like over 6'3 to be a sprawler, but he is.
All right, Kyle, let's move to the Ivy League, which actually this tournament could be very, very fun to watch. We've got a rematch of Yale versus Cornell and then Brown versus Penn. Quick aside, really disappointed that Michael Sowers is not playing in this tournament. But who is your favorite, Kyle?
Again, the tiebreaker here, and this is a motivator for my people in Philly, is Yale. I think that Yale, while they have the same argument that I kind of have with Notre Dame, why are you scared of Yale? You're scared of Yale because of TD Ireland. If you can make that matchup 50-50, what else are you scared of? I think the only answer is transition, because this is a team that has a stable full of thoroughbreds that will run with anyone and can keep up with your transition, stop your transition, and turn it back into theirs and score. I don't think they're like a top team in the 6-on-6, but I also think it doesn't matter because they do so many little things really well.
Okay. Kyle, I would pick Penn as my dark horse here. But since you already picked a number one seed as the dark horse, I'm just going to make the case for Cornell. I think that they're a team that if they scrap and get those extra possessions and get it to their offense, they will score. And we saw this last year. You know, Yale decided to play Jeff Teets straight up, and he dissected their defense the whole game. And it was really impressive. And I think that, you know, Cornell, they're one of those teams on the bubble right now. They have 100% motivation to go in here and win at least one game, if not the whole tournament. So that's the case for Cornell. Going to be a fun one in New York, though. All right, Kyle, time for some action. Marist versus Canisius and Quinnipiac versus Detroit Mercy. How about those pronunciations?
Good work.
The favorite.
Do you even know?
I mean,
you don't even know. How many teams have you watched this year?
I mean, I feel like it, Quinnipiac, because they had that really like solid run in the middle of the season that was only recently stemmed. Detroit Mercy's coming off a loss.
No.
Marist just beat Canisius. You know, this was the tournament that absolutely went crazy last year. But I'll stick with Quinnipiac as the favorite.
Well, they're the third seed, so that's weird. But fair enough. I guess I can't use a number one. So I'm going to actually go with Canisius because I thought their loss to Marist was a bit of an upset. Even though Marist 6-1 in the conference, I feel like Canisius, you know, last year they won this. They were in it. They had to like have that self-belief to get to that point to win. And I think that, you know, they've had some rough losses this season, but I think that there's still a little gas left in the tank and they can make a move for conference championship supremacy.
Let's go to Kyle, our favorite conference, the NEC, the NEC. We've got Hobart versus Sacred Heart. By the way, that should actually be a really good game. Lots of goals expected. And then the Mount versus Bobby Moe, Mount St. Mary's versus Robert Morris. Who is your favorite, Kyle?
This one's actually tough too, man. I mean, the Mount have the number one seed, but the Mount let me down last week, so I'm not picking the Mount, Tommy Lyons. I'm not doing it. I'm going to go with Hobart. I just think that they're going to reclaim some sort of their offense. It's just, it has to happen, even though Bobby Moe came back, beat them in OT. Hobart was winning that game for long periods of time this past weekend. I was scoring it, watching it, checking it out. Camera angles were atrocious, but neither here nor there. I think Hobart can do it. They got a great faceoff guy in Matthew Pettisine, too.
You know, funny enough, I feel like as hard as it was to pick the favorite, it's equally as hard to pick the dark horse here because I think all four of these teams could win this tournament. I don't know. I guess I'll make the case for the Mount. Like, I don't know how the number one seed can be the dark horse, but yes, I think that
I got one and you got one. That's it. We can't do it again.
But yeah, the Mount. I'll choose the Mount here. All right, the SoCon. The matchups are Jacksonville versus High Point and Air Force versus Richmond. I'm going to pick the easy one here. The favorite is High Point. A lot of their victories have been close, but, you know, like you said on the podcast last week, if you're determining which way to go in picking a team, you pick the team with the best player, you pick the team with the best goalie. That's absolutely got to be High Point with Astrid Nolting on attack and Timmy Trautner in cage. Who's your dark horse, though?
Yeah, you know who I'm going to say, but I don't think you can pick Richmond. So I'm going to go with the Finns in this one. Winners of their last three games, including a one-goal win over Firm that kind of got them into this position, a 20-12 drubbing of Mercer. This is a team that's angry they didn't have a better season. And I think they're hungry to prove that they are a very good team. And, you know, they have a bunch of losses. They go on two loss streaks. They had a real bad start. But I really think that they've kind of gotten it together here in the last 2 months, and they're ready to go. So I'm going to go with Jacksonville.
Wow, I'm really surprised he did not say Air Force. Air Force, after they lost to Utah in midseason, are 8-2 in their last 10 games. Doubled up Richmond. So let's see how this rematch goes. Kyle, let's move to the big boy, the Patriot League, which has quarterfinals. BU versus Bucknell, and then Army versus Holy Cross, Lehigh and Loyola with the first round byes. What do you say here? Who's the favorite?
You have the favorite for this one.
Oh, I do.
You do.
Loyola.
Yeah. Come on.
Pat Spencer.
Of course it is. Yeah. Pat Spencer. You picked the best player. Best goalie, too. Good job. I'm going to go against type. And I'm going to go with the birthplace of a legend in New England. Maybe you've heard of him. Two legends. Bob Cousy and Bill Simmons. Alums of Holy Cross. As the dark horse. What do you think about that, Dan? What do you think about Holy Cross? What do you know about Worcester? What do you know about Worcester? Nothing. You don't know nothing.
If you had said Boston University, I would have walked up out of this podcast room and just left.
Well, Holy Cross is actually worse because it's in the same town that I went to college in. So it's actually more of a homer pick, just personally related. But your point is well taken.
But no, Holy Cross, you know, this will be a fun matchup with Army here. Holy Cross is super pumped to be in this tournament. So, yeah, that'll be a fun one.
Holy Cross can beat Army. I'm telling you right now. That's a possibility.
And there's, you know, the Patriot League. The Patriot League quarters and the semis have seen a lot of chaos outside of Loyola playing. So there's potential there. All right, Kyle, that is our conference recap. And we now turn to Thrones Watch of the Week. All right. Disclaimer. We will be discussing Game of Thrones Season 8, Episode 3, spoilers in depth. So if you do not want to hear these spoilers or simply do not care about our little fascination with this fantasy show, please skip ahead to the appropriate juncture. Kyle, please set the table for this conversation.
Okay. I was hot about this, hot under the collar about this for a long time last night and the night before that. But then I remembered how much I loved Avengers Endgame, how much I still love it, and how mad I was when people were trying to tear the movie apart all over the internet. Maybe you've heard of it. It's a movie that had a $1.2 billion opening weekend. Probably should see it. So I'm going to have a little more sensitivity here than I originally planned and only focus on two main criticisms. One, and I said this on Twitter, the first half hour of this show is not well shot. This episode, not well shot. Maybe the worst shot in Game of Thrones history. And I'm not talking about the darkness or the contrast. I mean, the camera angles. They are Transformers Michael Bay level confusing. People getting dogpiled by undead monsters die. That's how it is. They kept faking us out with deaths, Walking Dead style, and it was really all one or two shots of an actor against a wall or on the ground. I just think that's lazy. This is Game of Thrones, not Walker, Texas Ranger. Figure it out. And the dragon battles had exactly two good establishing shots, and the actual combat, aside from one shot of whoever's dragon, because we couldn't tell who that was, fighting against the Night King's dragon, Viserion, was the only other good shot in the actual battle. Everything else was gibberish. Just couldn't tell what was going on. Point two. Killing the Night King, while done in a cool way, undercuts the rest of this show, and I'm pretty bummed about it. Who is the Night King? Why was he trying to snatch Bran? Why did Bran warg for no reason other than to satisfy his curiosity about, what's the Night King doing? It's not like he was going to help anyone with that information. He's chilling by the weirwood. The Night King was a great, not good, great Terminator-like villain. The shot where Daenerys yells Dracarys and the Drogon breathes fire on him. And you're like, oh, yeah, yeah, later Night King. And then he's like unscathed. And one of the only times he shows emotion, smiles and like walks away. That's amazing. And this is the same dude that went down like he was a pint glass dropped at a bar. So how do you do one of those? And then he dies like, I mean, it was a great death. It was a great resolution. It was, but it wasn't a great resolution is kind of what I'm saying. Great death, great scene, great payoff. Not the after it happened, you're kind of like, oh, wait, we're never going to know though. I think that's part of, you know, the mystique of the show is trying to figure out why this is happening. And now we'll never know, which kind of sucks. But yeah. One thing before you go, I'm going to let you finish. I'm going to let you go. But as I mentioned earlier, Avengers Endgame, no spoilers for that, is amazing. I cried from happiness, not sadness. The poetry of the movie is moving to all but the most cynical human beings. I can't wait to see it again. Dan, I expect you to have no emotional reaction.
I did not see Endgame yet, hoping to see it soon. But in terms of Game of Thrones, just want to say, I thoroughly enjoyed that whole episode. But I find the critical commentary surrounding it very agreeable. So I'm going to address some of your points and go into my own a little bit. Number one, I actually like the first 30 minutes, maybe more than the final hour or so. I think Game of Thrones, in the past two seasons, working outside of the source material of the books, has really leaned hard on clout and the forgiveness of the viewers. This episode pushed it a bit. There are some very odd shot continuity errors in this episode. So much so that there is a thread on the A Song of Ice and Fire subreddit titled, "Tonight's episode was the most blatantly lazy, inconsistently cheap, and disappointing episode of the series, and HBO's reputation should be on the line for it. Extreme, yes, but it harps on two things that did catch my eye."
I totally didn't write that.
That is a Kyle headline. But it did center on two things that did catch my eye. And the two most notable errors are John being absolutely surrounded by whites when he's like charging at the Night King. And then 2 minutes later, he has like a complete exit path and the bungling whites are just like trying to attack him one by one. Then in the Godswood with Theon and Bran, the Ironborn, like there's a scene where like they look to be completely overwhelmed by whites. And then next scene, when we cut back to him, the whites are conveniently charging piecemeal and getting picked off by arrows like flies. The showrunners have to be insane if they think we weren't going to notice those. Also, can we talk about the logic of their battle plans, which even casual viewers are calling out? We're talking about a cavalry charge straight at static infantry to start the battle. That's Bush League, man.
Did they threw the dudes on horses out and then shot the trebuchets? Why did you do that? Why didn't you shoot those first, send the cavalry wave in? And also, why are you all sending them in at the same time? And why are they going in a straight line? Why is no one flanking?
That's flankers, a whole Dan? Podcast, Kyle, in and it's of itself. To my second point, number two, let's be real. Arya coming out of nowhere and switching up on the Night King and completely obliterating him and his army with that dagger was one of the most friggin' awesome moments I've ever seen on screen. I was with my boys watching it, and it was like a reaction similar to when Villanova won against North Carolina that one year in NCAA March Madness. But I'm in agreement with you. We haven't really explored the lore and the motives of the Night King and his army and what their purpose is. And the show cannot just drop their storyline after eight seasons of intense buildup and paint them as some absolute evil program to wipe out mankind. That's not how this show works. The show is about complexity. If they don't explore that in the following episode, then that's a cop-out. But I'm hoping Mr. Know-It-All, Bran, has some insight for us, just waiting. Point three, speaking of Bran, like, dude, what the heck, man? I've got to go now? Okay, cool. You warged into a bunch of ravens. To do what, though? See how bad humanity is getting their teeth knocked in? Cool, bro. I know maybe there's something about the Night King only knowing his location when Bran wargs, but still, like, great contribution, bro. Your superpower is really dope. Congrats. Point four. While the plot armor was insanely thick for most of the fan favorites, there were some hard-hitting deaths in this episode.
Yeah.
Lyanna Mormont, Little Lady Mormont, absolutely talked the talk and walked the walk, did not back down, and went out like an absolute boss, as you mentioned early in the podcast, taking out a giant with a dragonglass dagger. Then Beric Dondarrion sacrificing himself was really nice. Then Jorah proving he really was ride or die for Daenerys to the very end. I thought he had a little bit of a touching end. I didn't cry, but damn,
yeah.
I felt bummed to see him go.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Well, hold on. Let this be a lesson to everyone in the friend zone. Get out. Get out. You don't want to die for her, man. I'm going to tell you right now. You don't want to do it. Get out. Don't stay there. Look what happened to Jorah. Get out.
Yeah. And finally, Theon, man. What an unbelievable character arc and performance through 8 seasons from Theon, portrayed by Alfie Allen. I don't know if there's been a character in anything I've watched that I've completely flipped on. Like, I hated Theon so much. And then, like, when he was getting tortured by Ramsay, I was like, you deserve this, bro. And then now, he completely flips his arc, redeems himself entirely, and goes out the way he did. That really is impressive storytelling, in my opinion. So shout out Theon. I think one of the more underrated characters on the show, incredible arc. But yeah, so yeah, I enjoyed this episode, but it's far and away, this is a bit hot take, far and away my least favorite of all the battle sequences we've seen on this show. I think the ultimate cinematic achievement for them was the Battle of the Bastards. That was it. I think there's a lot of work to be done post-script in the next episode, though. Otherwise, I think the showrunners may be dropping the ball here a bit. Yes, I did not see Endgame, Kyle. Sorry. I'm trying to see it this week. Whew. Feel better now, Kyle?
I mean, I'm a little lighter in the shoulders. Yeah, I feel good. Also, I want to correct, you know, not just dudes can be in the friend zone. It's not what I meant. Ladies, if you're in the friend zone, get out. You know, want to be gender neutral with it. It's good advice, though.
Kyle, don't back stay there. To lacrosse talk. Dive, rule, debate. What do we have here now?
I feel like we could get into some of the shenanigans in the High Point Richmond game, but then we'd be slipping even further into a malaise that I would prefer to avoid for another week at least. Let's just say that our prophecy of a big game being decided by a bad dive call is still very, very much in play. And this is more of a PSA than a debate. It's not going away. It's still around. And bad calls still happen.
Do you think we'll see such an incident in one of these conference playoffs?
Yes. I don't think it'll decide a game. I think that the gods will save it for the NCAA tournament, possibly the Final Four, to have it reach critical mass. Because that really just proves the point that's been going on all season. It's going to lead to another rule change of the rule change of the rule that didn't exist. So I'm just saying, be ready for it. Always be alert for the dive rule.
All right, Kyle, moving on to our final segment, the Tucker Dordovic Play of the Week. I'm going to lead it out here. The play of the week is all those dudes selling out for ground balls this past weekend. The Virginia versus North Carolina game in particular, John Fox selling out for a ground ball leads to a Dox Aiken goal late in the game. And then on the game winner, Matt Jama, absolutely selling out for a grounder, gets it to another player who gets it to another player who gets it to Ian Laviano for the go-ahead score with about 90 seconds left to play in the game. Ground balls literally win games. In this case, it was very much the case.
Yeah, you're not wrong. I will say I don't recall a specific goal that made me jump out of my seat, but the games I wrote about, which were mostly like NEC games this weekend and some CAA stuff, were more about saves than goals. But still, I like Notre Dame's Brian Costabile's first goal against Duke. Just a vicious corner destroying snipe that Upgren didn't even move to save. Couldn't move to save. Not super dramatic considering how many great game-winning goals we got all weekend, but man, sometimes you need to step back, reassess, and appreciate good snizzles. And that's what that was.
Yeah, it was a fantastic weekend. And man, I cannot believe it's like, what, one day away from May?
Yeah, we're in May, man.
Season's over, bro.
May Madness.
Season's over. Like, May Madness is going to just, it's just going to tear us apart. It's going to be amazing.
What do we say to the God of Death, Dan?
Not today.
Not today.
If you appreciate the podcast, have friends who are getting into lacrosse around this time of year, we hope that you would recommend this podcast to them, especially if they like entertainment like we do. You can find me on Twitter at Dan_Abern. Kyle, where can they find you?
You can find me at TheKyleDevitt on Twitter.
Well, we hope you guys appreciate the conference tournaments coming up. We'll see y'all next week, and maybe we'll have some Avengers Endgame chat for you. See y'all.